I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome to Radio Times. Day two of the January 6th House Committee hearing yesterday presented their case that former President Trump was told repeatedly by his circle of campaign advisors, members of his family, and the Attorney General that he had lost the 2020 election while he persisted in making false public statements about voter fraud. Trump relied increasingly on Rudy Giuliani, Sidney Powell, and others who were feeding him out outlandish and bogus conspiracy theories about a stolen election, including the Dominion voting machines. William Barr told the committee that Trump, quote, had become detached from reality if he believes this stuff. There was never an indication of interest in what the actual facts were, unquote. According to the committee, Trump and his campaign aides used the lies about election fraud to raise $250 million, misleading donors about how the money was being spent. Representative Zoe Lofgren called it the big ripoff. Former Philadelphia City Commissioner Republican Al Schmidt testified yesterday about the harassment, including death threats, he and his family faced after Trump criticized him by name on Twitter. Here's how he answered a question posed by Representative Lofgren.
So President Trump made numerous claims regarding fraudulent voting practices in Philadelphia, including the claim that dead people were voting. In fact, Mr. Giuliani told Pennsylvania state legislators that 8,000 dead people voted in Pennsylvania. You investigated those claims of voter fraud. Can you tell us what you found?
Not only was there not evidence of 8,000 dead voters voting in Pennsylvania, there wasn't evidence of eight.
And joining us and sitting across from me is Al Schmidt, former Philadelphia City Commissioner. He was the lone Republican on the three-member city election board. Testified yesterday, as we just heard, he's now president and CEO of the Committee of 70, and that's a nonpartisan government watchdog organization here in Philadelphia. Al Schmidt, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Yeah, thank you, Marty.
You're very welcome. And joining us by phone is Luke Broadwater. He's congressional reporter for the New York Times who has been covering the January 6th investigation. And Luke Broadwater, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Al, let me just begin with you and just finish up with some of the testimony that you gave yesterday. You were asked a couple of questions, and you did say, we investigated everything, no matter how fantastical. How many investigations did you have to go into? How many allegations of some kind of nefarious voting?
Well, in the course of my 10 years as city commissioner, it would have been many, many hundreds of cases that we investigated, whether there was sort of actual evidence of them that we pursued to determine whether it was legitimate or not, or just people who called in to make accusations. It was important for us to always take accusations like that seriously. I've always taken voter fraud very seriously. I was a Republican responsible for running elections in Philadelphia. And I worked on that for 10 years and made referrals when there was actual evidence to back them up.
And were there more allegations during the 2020 election or as a result of or reaction to?
Not in terms of sort of individual accusations. There was a lot online, suggestions that the deceased boxer from Philly, Joe Frazier, had voted and had a voting history. He, of course, had not voted since before he was deceased, which is also when his voter record was canceled. Allegations that some number of police officers who had been killed in the line of duty had voted, which would, of course, be like an incendiary, upsetting thing for their families and for voters and for everybody. No truth to any of that either. But even though we were in the middle of counting our voters' votes, it was important for us to look into those things and either make a referral if they're real or knock them down if they're false.
You mentioned and in fact told us on Radio Times that it was very clear that you had death threats, your family had death threats, and certainly harassment as a result of what you did, essentially counting the votes here in Philadelphia in 2020. You testified yesterday in a very public hearing. Are you concerned about your safety, the safety of your family as a result of that?
Well, I am, but I'm equally concerned about the safety of election administrators across the country. I wasn't the only one. I didn't have it the worst. There are many more than me, and many had it worse. The problem is this big shift between campaigns where typically candidates compete against other candidates, but now we have campaigns where they're campaigning against the people who run elections. And all those people are doing are seeking to count their voters' votes. It shouldn't be a controversial thing. It certainly shouldn't be something warranting death threats to them and their families.
Look, I will get back to you, Al Schmidt. Luke Broadwater, let me get you in on the conversation. You watched the hearing yesterday, and I do want to talk about a lot of what we learned, and we'll be playing some clips as well. But what was your overall takeaway?
Right. I thought it was another very effective presentation by the January 6th committee. The first hearing last week, I thought, was very powerful in terms of the emotional impact. You heard firsthand from a Capitol Police officer who had been suffered a traumatic brain injury. And you saw very visceral video of the Proud Boys attack in the Capitol. And the committee really laid out the sort of seven-part plan to overturn the election on behalf of Donald Trump and his allies. I would say this second hearing was more surgical. It got into the details, perhaps even more, and really featured a lot of the testimony from former Attorney General Bill Barr, who said that he thought the president had a break with reality when he was pushing all these claims of fraud. And again, I think you had the people like Mr. Schmidt, who presented evidence and said, we investigated this stuff and it just wasn't true, and then heard about the blowback that they received. I thought one more very important point the committee raised was the fundraising that the Trump campaign did off of the lies of a stolen election, and how they brought in $250 million from Trump's donors. But there was no actual election defense fund that money went to. In fact, some of it went to Trump's hotels, and some of it went to Mr. Trump's allies, different organizations or businesses. And so the committee tried to establish that there was not only a big lie, but that there was a big ripoff as well.
And I do want to get to the big riff-off. Let me play a clip, and this is a video of committee interviewing shows former Attorney General Bill Barr explaining what it was like to deal with former President Trump's allegations of election fraud. Let's give it a listen.
There was an avalanche of all these allegations of fraud that built up over a number of days, and it was like playing whack-a-mole because something would come out one day, and then the next day it would be another issue. Also, I was influenced by the fact that all the early claims that I understood were completely bogus and silly and usually based on complete misinformation. And so I didn't consider the quality of claims right out of the box to give me any, feeling that there was really substance here.
Al, you nodded about whack-a-mole. Did it feel like that?
Yeah, it certainly did. I mean, because the embrace of this sort of paranoid fantasy of a stolen election was so important, I think, once the former president realized he lost, it became more and more absurd, more and more extreme. And also, just to remind you, the election in Pennsylvania wasn't even close. It was 80,000 votes. So if you're making allegations of voter fraud, it clearly became insufficient to suggest one here or two there, and instead you had to make suggestions about Dominion voting machines switching votes and truckloads of counterfeit, Chinese ballots being smuggled in by South Philly organized crime figures to the convention center. Just the most absurd stuff that people fell for.
And to you, Luke, going back to Bill Barr, and they played a lot of the videotape testimony from Barr. But I do have to say, where was he for the last year and a half when former President Trump has been promoting and touting the idea that this was a stolen election, that there was voter fraud? He has been largely and strangely silent on that, at least publicly.
Yeah, I think a lot of Democrats were probably surprised to learn that Bill Barr has emerged as as one of the star witnesses for the January 6th committee. If you recall, of course, Bill Barr, in a memo, authorized his prosecutors in the Justice Department to investigate claims of fraud. And at the time, many people felt that that was sort of an irresponsible memo, that this was, he was pouring fuel on the fire of false claims. But ultimately, when they did those investigations and found that there was no substance to them, he did make the statement to the Associated Press that he had found no fraud that could have overturned the election. And that brought about the anger of Donald Trump. And, you know, we didn't hear all of this necessarily in real time, but Bill Barr recently released a book in which he detailed some of these conversations with Donald Trump. And now you saw this testimony from him about three different times going in to Donald Trump and telling him that, in his words, this was BS.
That this was BS. He was, though, interviewed, I believe, recently, Luke, and told the interviewer that, you know, if it came down to Donald Trump as the Republican nominee and a Democrat, he would vote for the Republican nominee.
Right. I mean, you know, Bill Barr is a Republican through and through, and even somebody that he believes is not in touch with reality, as he said. He said he was essentially delusional. I guess he still prefers a delusional person and a serial liar to a Democrat. So that's his point of view.
One of the things we learned yesterday, Al, and this was from the Fox editor, whose job it is on election night to figure out who won and who lost, essentially. But he did say something interesting. He talked about the red mirage, that when it came to in-person voting, you're generally going to get Republicans. When it's absentee voting, you're generally going to get Democrats. So you have to take that into account when determining who's winning and who's losing.
And while that's long been the case, it was even more so in 2020, because the former president was discouraging Republicans from voting by mail. So fewer Republicans voted by mail. So in a city like Philadelphia, that's 7-1 Democratic to Republican, those results are more like 17-1 because of fewer Republicans voting by mail. The other thing is, as you recall, voting by mail was new in Pennsylvania in 2020, unrelated to the COVID environment, had been passed in 2019. And while the law expanded voting, allowing people to vote by mail with no excuse, the election code never permitted those mail-in ballot envelopes to be reviewed prior to election morning, which really delayed it.
So not even opened, right?
Not even opened. And there's all sorts of steps that you have to go through with each envelope before that envelope can be opened and that vote can be counted. And it takes a while. It's a long assembly line, essentially, from tooth to tail. It delays the results. And people took advantage of that.
And it wasn't until Saturday until we got the results from Pennsylvania.
That's right.
We are talking with Al Schmidt and Luke Broadwater, talking about yesterday's House committee hearing investigating the insurrection and the events leading up to it. And we're going to take a very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, and we're talking about what we learned from the January 6th House Committee hearing yesterday about the lies perpetrated by former President Trump and his allies about election fraud and how those lies were used to raise millions of dollars from unwitting supporters. Our guests are Al Schmidt. He's a former Philadelphia City Commissioner, was a Republican on the three-member city election board. He testified yesterday before the House Select Committee. He's now the president and CEO of the Committee of 70. That's a nonpartisan government watchdog organization here in Philadelphia. And Luke Broadwater joining us as well. He's congressional reporter for the New York Times, has been covering the January 6th investigation. And we got word this morning that the House January 6th committee has postponed tomorrow's hearing. Representative Zoe Lofgren says that the rescheduling is due to, quote, technical issues, and the next hearing is on Thursday. You can can join us, email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can pick up the phone and give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Luke, do we know how many people tuned in yesterday for the hearing?
I have not heard the latest ratings. We do know that more than 20 million people watched the first hearing. I assume this number will be much, much lower because it was at 10 a.m. Instead of, or rather, it didn't go until close to 11 a.m. rather than a primetime viewership. Still, I mean, for a congressional hearing to get 20 million people is unheard of. Most of the congressional hearings I watch probably have a few hundred people that watch them.
Really? So, really?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that's just a jaw-dropping number, in my opinion.
Well, and they brought in a TV producer, I mean, to help sort of create an event that people can, I guess, can watch, Luke. I mean, as a, not exactly a TV show, but something that approximates that.
Yes. I mean, this was so different than your normal congressional hearing. I mean, a normal congressional hearing will last all day. It will stretch on for hours and hours. It will have very boring testimony. It will often get bogged down in a endless cycle of back and forth between Republican and Democrats who are, you know, grandstanding and trying to win political points, and oftentimes not much is learned. This was very streamlined, both of these hearings. They were both about 2 hours. There was no sort of opposition throwing monkey wrenches into the works, so they could lay out a very clear and clean narrative of what happened and do it in a way that was almost like a movie. It was in a very digestible portion, and I do think that was effective to getting people to tune in.
What was it like to be sitting there, Al Schmidt?
Well, I mean, it's pretty intense.
I bet.
You certainly
get the sense that— A lot of cameras on your face,
right? You certainly get the sense that, you know, there's a lot of eyes on you and a lot of ears listening to what you have to say and what the committee is doing, and I think that's— I think that's really important. I think the how well done this is and how important it is that they create a historical record here for the future, that it is compiled essentially contemporaneously, because, you know, I have no doubt that this was a big event in American history, what occurred on January 6th, and it's yet to be determined where we're going to go from here, but it's important that people understand what occurred and why.
I mean, I agree with you, an important event in history. And I guess the question is, do people feel it's important now? You know, do we have to wait for history, or can we deal with what we're learning now?
And I'm sure there's a lot of people out there who don't want to learn anymore.
Right.
That want to say, oh, no, this is all old news. Let's put it behind us and, you know, try to point fingers. And like Kevin McCarthy said, that everyone is responsible for what happened on January 6th, or to deny that anyone did anything wrong at all.
Did you know the questions you were going to be asked? Did they give you a heads up at all, outline at all?
They gave me a sense of what they'd be asking about. I obviously knew they were going to be asking about Philly. I knew they were going to be asking about allegations of voter fraud. I knew they were going to be asking about the threats that sort of came my way, directed toward me and my team, my chief deputy commissioner, Seth Bluestein, who replaced me as commissioner. Philly is better with Seth than with me. So it was easy to make the decision to go to 70, knowing that elections would be in good hands. So we had a sense of what they were going to ask about, but not specific questions.
You know, Luke, there were a number. We played Bill Barr, but others, you know, talking about the former president's state of mind, his unwillingness to accept the truth or to accept the facts. And we're also learning from these hearings and from your reporting and other people is that there were people who were members of the administration who were thinking about the 25th Amendment. I mean, the idea of somehow removing him from office because of his, quote, you know, his unfitness. Can you expand on that for us at all?
Yes, absolutely. That was brought up at the first hearing, that some of Trump's cabinet after January 6th had thought about invoking the 25th Amendment to remove him from office before the end of his term. This was something that Betsy DeVos had had access to some of those conversations, some of the other top advisors as well. Ultimately, they did not take that step. It was just something that was talked about, but that shows you how concerned they were about what President Trump was doing and the havoc his lies had caused at the mm-hmm. Capitol. I do think it was, almost breathtaking to hear from so many people inside both the campaign and the White House who told Donald Trump to his face that what he was doing was wrong. I mean, his campaign manager, his campaign advisor, the attorney general, the acting attorney general after him. I mean, it was person after person after person. And instead, he went with his own advice to himself, which was just to lie about it. And then two, he welcomed advice from an apparently drunk Rudy Giuliani, who also thought that this was a good idea to just lie about having won the election.
When Representative Liz Cheney talked about the inebriated Rudy Giuliani, I texted with my staff because we were all watching going, holy moly. And yet, Luke, we heard from, I think it was Miller, who seemed to believe that he was in that inebriated state.
Yeah, both Miller and Stepien, the campaign manager, testified to the fact that Rudy Giuliani was intoxicated at the time. Rudy Giuliani being intoxicated is probably not the most important thing in the world, but I guess it does get to, the quality of the advice Donald Trump was getting. And frankly, there's always been this conversation around Trump about whether you should blame his advisors or blame him for the things he does. And it does seem very clear that Trump wanted to believe any lie he was told as long as it confirmed that he won the election in his view. And so he welcomed that. And, he threw out any of the good advice he did get in favor of people who told him what he wanted to hear.
Let me read a couple of comments. One for you, Al Schmidt, from Kyle, saying, did the commissioner ever think he'd literally be on the front lines battling for democracy?
No. And while election commissioners and election administrators play such an important role in making our democracy function, no one ever went into this position thinking that really anyone would ever pay attention to them unless something went wrong, right? There's never a headline the day after Election Day that is, election went great. voters voted without any issues. You're really only getting attention when things go wrong. When 2020 happened, it really changed that because the 2020 election was actually a pretty smooth election, one of the smoothest that I can recall, especially with that level of turnout. It really went smoothly until all this sort of disruption intruded from the outside.
There have been so many studies disproving election fraud. Even before 2020, from the Brennan Center, I'm thinking of all the people that have looked at it. It's minuscule, and it's often just someone makes a mistake, and occasionally there is some election fraud. I'm looking at you, who you probably know this more than I do, but nonetheless, and yet this is an issue that so many people believe is true. How do you disprove it?
It is, but and I just want to add, it's always important that we remain vigorous in pursuing allegations of voter fraud, right? It's important that even if we're talking about one or two votes, that we sort of not ever kind of turn a blind eye to it, but really, really pursue it, really take it seriously. And then when you have cases, which we very rarely but occasionally have, mm-hmm. it should give people confidence that there are safeguards in the system, and that while voter fraud occurs rarely, when it does occur, it's generally easy to detect taken seriously by law enforcement.
Luke, do you want to weigh in on that at all?
Yes, I mean, I do think that as fanciful and fantastical as these claims became under Donald Trump, you did see at this hearing that many agencies did actually investigate the claims of fraud. You heard from the former U.S. attorney in Atlanta who investigated the claims that there were sort of suitcases of fraudulent votes that were brought in the middle of the night to to give Joe Biden the victory in Georgia. And he investigated that and found out it was not true, that was just normal votes being counted. And once he did that and made those statements, he was pressured to resign. So, I mean, people did take these allegations seriously. They did investigate them. But at some point, they become so ridiculous. I mean, how do you investigate whether defense contractors in Italy are using thermometers to flip votes from remotely in Dominion machines? I mean, it's completely bonkers stuff. But no matter how crazy it was, Donald Trump wanted to believe it, and so he kept pushing it. And then you saw a video of the rioters at the Capitol that day repeating some of this stuff, saying, Dominion voting machines. How do they know about Dominion voting machines? Because Trump and his allies pushed this lie on the public.
Well, and Sidney Powell is being sued by Dominion. And Luke, I don't have her exact words, but, you know, to summarize them, her response is, well, why would you believe anything I say, or something to that effect?
Yeah, one of the defenses she put forth in court was that basically no reasonable person would have believed their press conference that they gave where, I mean, they blamed Hugo Chavez. Hugo Chavez had been dead since 2013. I mean, the stuff was so insane, and yet it gained, and it was almost laughable in some ways. I mean, you saw in the video of Bill Barr, he starts laughing at how insane this is, but it's not funny when thousands of people believe it, storm the Capitol, beat police, give people traumatic brain injuries, and try to overturn an election over it. So it is absurdly hilarious in some ways, but it's also deadly serious.
Well, I also thought, Al, that by talking about the tweet that Trump aimed at you, the critical tweet at Trump, and then what happened to you and your family, I don't want to belabor that, but nonetheless, harassment and even death threats. I think they were trying to make a connection between when someone tweets something or when the former president tweets something, people react and sometimes react violently.
They do. And, you know, I have little doubt that many of the people who did terrible things, I mean, they're probably terrible people to begin with, right? Somebody doesn't just decide to threaten to murder someone else's children. But what I think is very interesting to see and was revealed through the death threats and revealed on January 6th is that while they undoubtedly love America and believe they love America, they sure hate democracy when their candidate doesn't win. And it's embracing America with one hand and really rejecting democracy with the other. And I think that's very dangerous.
Well, indeed. And I think it's also historic in that this is the first time a president, I believe in our history, that a president lost and essentially sort of refused the results of the election to this day.
That, again, was not even close.
Was not even close, exactly. Let me just read a couple of more comments here. One from Richard. In light of Trump's repeated claims prior to both the 2016 and 2020 elections that if he lost the elections, then it was rigged, how can anyone conclude anything other than Trump was ready and willing to lie and did so? A comment from John. Is any of this going to matter when Trump supporters aren't watching and are being fed Trump propaganda? Is any of this seeping through? I wonder, Luke, if you want to take either of those. And it is true that Trump early on, well before the November election, was saying that it was rigged and there will be fraud. But nonetheless, any response to our callers?
Yeah, I mean, that's the caller's exactly right. The Donald Trump had a long history of claiming there was fraud whenever he didn't like something. I mean, he claimed, I think the Emmys were fraudulent one year. He claimed that when he lost in Iowa to Ted Cruz in a Republican primary, there was fraud in that election. He when he thought he was going to lose to Hillary Clinton, he claimed the election would be rigged, that he won it, the same election he thought was rigged. And then again, he saw he was behind in the polls going into the match with Joe Biden, to the contest with Joe Biden, and he started to claim that would be rigged. And he started to, I think, hurt his own chances by casting doubt on mail-in ballots, and instead of encouraging his supporters to use them, he discouraged them and said they were fraudulent, which is, you know, his advisors told him was not a good strategy. So that is true. As to whether it breaks through, you know, I don't know.
Yeah.
One indication of whether it is making some impact is that Fox News did not carry the first hearing, but did carry the second one live. And you saw after the first hearing, there were editorials in papers owned by Rupert Murdoch saying basically we need to move on from Trump. The Republican Party needs to move on from Trump. So maybe that has some influence. I don't know. And if 20 million people watched, maybe all 20 were strong Biden supporters. But I would bet there's some people in the middle who watched it, maybe even some Trump supporters.
You're Republican, Al Schmidt. Should we move on from this?
Well, I would hope that the country doesn't move on from it in a way where they just, you know, cover their eyes and have their hands over their ears and pretend like it never happened. I think it has to be – we need to move on from this in a way that's constructive, that we can reconcile what happened and get it right so things don't get worse.
What do you hope – I mean, there are a couple of more hearings. What do you hope the hearings, though, accomplish in total? I mean, once all is said and done, what do you want the takeaway to be?
You know, on some level, I'm hopeful that in addition to creating a historical record, that there is some element of accountability that comes from all of this. And whether that involves anyone being prosecuted or not, I don't know. But certainly American voters holding people accountable for the damage that's been done to our democracy and for what? Damage that's been done based on no credible allegations that the election was stolen, and so many people have been deceived by it all, and that's really just pretty lousy.
Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Al Schmidt. He's here with us in our Philadelphia studio, former Philadelphia City Commissioner. He sat on the 3-member election board and oversaw the 2020 election, among others. He testified yesterday before the House Select Committee, now president and CEO of the Committee of 70. Luke Broadwater joining us by phone, congressional reporter for The New York Times, and he has been covering the January 6th investigation. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We're talking about yesterday's January 6th hearing, and let me play two more clips. The first one is Bill Stepien. He's Trump's former campaign manager, and here he is sharing why he decided to leave the campaign. This is in video testimony showed yesterday. It is lightly edited.
I've been doing this for a long time, 25 years, and I've spanned, you know, political ideologies from Trump to McCain to Bush to Christie. And I think along the way, I've built up a pretty good, I hope, a good reputation for being honest and professional. And I didn't think what was happening was necessarily honest or professional at that point in time. So yeah, that led to me stepping away.
And here's another tape deposition. This is a former Trump impeachment White House lawyer, Eric Hirschman, addressing false claims made by Rudy Giuliani and former Trump lawyer Sidney Powell after election night.
What they were proposing, I thought, was nuts. And in the theory, was also completely nuts, right? I mean, it was a combination of Italians, Germans. I mean, different things have been floating around as to who was involved. I remember Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. She has an affidavit from somebody who says they wrote a software in and something with the Philippines, and just all over the radar.
Luke, has former President Trump, has he responded at all to the two hearings?
Yes, he released a 12-page rambling screed yesterday. I think it was last night, in which he cited the movie 2000 Mules over and over and over again as proof that his false claims were true. This movie has been debunked by experts. President Trump also cited Peter Navarro's report called The Immaculate Deception in his 12-page letter last night. You know, Mr. Navarro refused to speak with the January 6th committee and is now indicted under a criminal contempt of Congress charge and facing jail time. So, you know, he still is doubling down on the idea that the election was stolen and there was widespread fraud, but he's not, I would say he's not using reputable sources for his belief. He's using the people who tell him what he wants to hear. And so he, you know, now some people say that maybe that's a defense, that if he truly believes the lie, it can't be fraud, because you could see that the January 6th committee was definitely building a case that there was a fraud perpetrated on the public by the former president.
And if you could take us back, if you don't mind, Hal Schmidt, to those couple of days in November. So we have election night, and then we've got until Saturday when the results were called for Pennsylvania, as you said, about 80,000 votes that Biden won by. But what it was like during those couple of days as you were here in Philadelphia, people were watching you. There were a couple of people came up with some, you know, nefarious, threatening ideas in mind. What was it like?
Inside of the convention center, you know, there was a real commitment on the part of myself and my two fellow commissioners to get it right and to also get it done as expeditiously as possible without in any way jeopardizing the integrity of the process. Because, you know, voters with voting by mail being new, voters are used to thinking they're going to know the results on election night unless it's really close.
Right.
But when half of your voters vote by mail, every election is conceivably close until you get enough votes counted. And in our case, half of our voters voted by mail in the general election of 2020. So 375,000 votes that were cast by mail that, again, we could not begin processing until election morning. So we knew it was going to take some time. That's why we had teams working around the clock for many days.
And you had people watching, and there were some protests outside.
We had observers from the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. We had a live feed showing the counting and everything sort of going on so that when there were rumors, which were untrue, on election night that we stopped counting. We never stopped counting. Our team worked for many days without a break.
And you're talking 24 hours a day?
24 hours a day in
wow.
shifts, yeah.
Wow. And these are people probably pay a little more than minimum wage to do this work?
And our clerks who, although half of our voters voted by mail, half of our voters voted in person on election day. So that meant many thousands of machines that had been programmed up to them at 1,703 divisions or precincts throughout the city. So it was it wasn't like a sprint at the end of a marathon. It was like a marathon at the end of a marathon that you had to run real fast.
And did Trump get more votes than Hillary Clinton?
Did Trump get more votes
in Philadelphia? Do we know?
Than Hillary Clinton in 2016. Oh,
yeah.
He did much better in 2020.
He did much
than
better
than he did in 16, which is kind of what's perverse about the accusations about Philadelphia too, because Trump got, I think, 22% more votes in 2020 than in 2016. Where he lost was not Philadelphia. Where he lost the 2020 election was in the suburbs of Philadelphia and a number of other places in the state.
Let me play one more clip. And this is something, Luke, that you raised, and we actually have a listener saying raising this as well. And I actually thought this was kind of the bombshell of yesterday. This is the Select Committee played a video of Amanda Wick. She's a senior investigative counsel for the committee, and she's explaining how Trump used the election fraud lie to raise hundreds of millions of dollars in donations. And again, this is a clip that's edited very lightly.
Between Election Day and January 6th, the Trump campaign sent millions of fundraising emails to Trump supporters, sometimes as many as 25 a day. The emails claimed the, quote, left-wing mob was undermining the election, implored supporters to, quote, step up to protect the integrity of the election, and encouraged them to, quote, fight back. But as the Select Committee has demonstrated, the Trump campaign knew these claims of voter fraud were false, yet they continued to barrage small-dollar donors with emails, encouraging them to donate to something called the Official Election Defense Fund. The Select Committee discovered no such fund existed. The claims that the election was stolen were so successful, President Trump and his allies raised $250 million, nearly $100 million in the first week after the election.
I mean, Luke, that's just jaw-dropping to raise that amount of money.
Yes, and, you know, I was talking with Jamie Raskin, one of the congressmen on the panel after the hearing, and he pointed out that typically after you lose an election, all your money dries up. People stop giving to you. No, there's not a rush on donations for a losing candidate in an election. But in this case, because of the lie of fraud and because they promised to their supporters that they were going to fight the election results in courts with this election defense fund, they were able to make tremendous amounts of money. And the fact that none of that money actually went to a so-called election defense fund, I think should be very troubling to many of those people who donated. And I know, speaking with some of the members of the committee and the committee staff, that they believe that this is an area where they can actually break through to Republicans. Maybe Republicans aren't mad that Donald Trump, you know, lied about the election, but they should be mad that they got conned out of their money. And so they think that this is maybe something that can have some impact with Donald Trump supporters.
And Luke, I get these emails every day from Trump. I don't know whether you do as a reporter yourself, but, you know,
maybe I got on his list. Yes,
I'm on his list as well. I mean, I get them all the time, you know, saying that the clock is running down. I mean, everyone does this who's running for office. But nonetheless, this was, you know, well after the election. Did you want to add something, Al? You just have a look on your face. No.
Yeah. I always have that look on my face.
This is what happens when you do in-person interviews. You get to see someone's face. Here's an email from Elaine. She says, you reported that he raised funds from unwitting supporters, but there were numerous hints of a scam. One was the sneaky recurring donation unless opted out. I wanted to extend my sympathies to those election officials and others who suffered unnecessarily from the absurd allegations. Do you want to take the bottom part, Al, about just her sympathies to election officials?
Yeah, the Brennan Center and other organizations have really been trying to get a handle on how widespread this is and why we're seeing or appear to be seeing a departure of so many people who are responsible for running elections across the country, whether it's related to this, whether it's related to just like a demographic bubble where you have a lot of people who've been in these positions for a long time, and then all of a sudden you're having to deal with all this nonsense, which is never, ever an aspect of the job before. And maybe they're old enough to retire and they just say, like, that's it. But the biggest dangers are a loss of institutional knowledge with people who have a lot of experience running elections. And even more dangerously, that those people get replaced by people who will be seeking to undermine confidence in the elections that they themselves are running.
Well, we have a governor's election in Pennsylvania this fall, and Mastriano, who's the Republican candidate for governor, was at the mall, at the U.S. Congress as well on January 6th. Whoever's governor of Pennsylvania gets to appoint the Secretary of State. Does that concern you?
That's right, and it's sort of beneath the radar, a lower profile. Throughout the country right now, you have a number of secretaries of state up for re-election or election, and they're responsible for running elections in their states. In Pennsylvania, as you said, the governor appoints the secretary of state. So while we don't have a race for secretary of state right now, we have a race for who will appoint the person responsible for running elections in the Commonwealth, and they'll be in that position for 2024, the next presidential.
And Luke, going back to you and even going back to the fundraising from the scams called the Big Ripoff, do you imagine class action suits? Do you imagine lawyers sort of pulling together people that might have made donations under some false pretenses?
You know, I don't know. You know, there are a number of lawsuits against Donald Trump over January 6th. But they've been generally by police officers who were injured or people who suffered from the mob violence in other ways. I have not seen a lawsuit against Trump's donors for being defrauded. I did think that was an interesting point one of your callers made about one of our stories where we interviewed people who had unwittingly been signed up for recurring donations to the Trump campaign, that there was a pre-checked box that made your donation just keep re-upping. And some poor donors lost a ton of money they couldn't afford. They thought they were giving maybe $20 once, and they ended up, emptying out their bank accounts. So, I have not heard talk of that sort of lawsuit, but I wonder if this elevated attention to this issue might get some lawyers thinking.
I mean, it does raise questions. I know you're not a lawyer, Luke, but just sort of, why is this, if not legal, why is this not being challenged in a court somewhere? Maybe now it will. I don't know.
Yeah, I know. I don't know. I guess they're... One thing I would speculate is that Donald Trump's supporters love him so much, and they put up with almost anything from him. And maybe some of them don't care that they got ripped off. But I don't know. I kind of suspect that given the heightened attention to this issue now, we might see something there.
Here's an email from Veronica. Listening, I agree the fraud claims were ludicrous and unbelievable, but some people believe this stuff. When Barr was chuckling so many times during his deposition, I found it infuriating. The politicians all know many Americans are flag patriots only and believe everything a political figure they believe in says. And if I can go back to you, Luke, Barr was chuckling several times during his deposition, and I know some people thought it was funny, some people thought it was off-putting. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I agree. I can see it both ways, honestly, because, I remember hearing some of this stuff during the build-up to the election to January 6th and just thinking it was absurd myself. I remember hearing about they were going to put forward fake slates of electors and thinking, what a ridiculous thing, how those will be rejected immediately. But it's not funny once a mob, a violent mob, believes it, and a violent mob decides to try to hang Mike Pence over it and beat police and cause us all to flee the building. I mean, I was there. We all getting rushed through the tunnels that day. I remember, it was not a funny situation while that was happening. It was a tragic situation. And yes, so to see someone laughing after January 6th, I could see how that does offend people.
And we're in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania just had a primary. Now we're in general, close to a general election in November. As someone now, the president, CEO of the Committee of 70, can we have confidence when we go to the polls to vote?
I think we should have confidence that elections are run by professionals who don't care about what the outcome is one way or another. Having worked in that world for 10 years, you're working alongside Democrats, you're working alongside Republicans, knowing people just statewide. These are really good, earnest, hardworking people that at the end of the day just want to count their voters' votes. Unfortunately, I think that this election cycle is really where we're going to see a lot of the consequences from 2020. Last year, other than in Virginia and New Jersey that had governor races, everything else was sort of municipal races. I think this election is really where we're going to find out what damage has been done or will be done as a result of 2020.
Well, I thank you for joining us once again. Thanks for the work that you do for election integrity as well, Al Schmidt.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. And he's former Philadelphia City Commissioner and did testify yesterday before the House Select Committee and now President and CEO of the Committee of 70, which is here in Philadelphia. Luke Broadwater, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. He is a congressional reporter for the New York Times and has been covering the January 6th investigation. To replay this hour, many more hours of Radio Times, go to WHYY.org and look for Radio Times under programs. You can also download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.